yeah. Well, that game is probably better than this.
Okay. All right,
if
man.
Anyone, yeah. Oh, sorry. Go ahead. I was going to say, they also made a Top Gun game, so if you want to go play that, be my guest.
Is that new?
Yeah. Oh. It just came out like 2 years ago or something.
Wow. Fantastic. Hey, what do I know about games? Hey, thanks for calling in. Talk to you next stay on the line for the panel, rather.
Okay.
Bye!
See ya.
John E. Capcom... What? I still have to read these for co-host. John E. Aren't you glad I didn't say Banana Capcom? All right, Keith, this is the time. Let's take it down a little bit. Let's calm ourselves down. No yelling. No yelling during the segments. Keith, let's open it up. Ralph Baer, get him on the line now. Joining us on We Talk Games, the inventor of the video game console, the first peripherals for a video game, the inventor of a cartridge-based system, the first electronic rhythm toy, and much, much more. It's an honor, a privilege to have Ralph Baer on We Talk Games. Welcome to the show, Ralph.
That's my pleasure.
Ralph, 1972, Magnavox released Odyssey, which was the first home game console available, 5 years before the Atari VCS, 10 years before the Commodore 64. But when did this idea first start?
Well, there's a debate about that in my own mind, because back in 51, when I worked for L'Oreal, which was a very small company then, pretty big today, I was hired to and actually built a television set from scratch with another guy. Two of us spent a year in a screen room building a TV set from scratch. And the reason why I was hired to do that was because I have a degree in television engineering. I got after the war, so World War II was over, and I came back home and took advantage of the GI Bill of Rights and became got a BS in TV engineering. During that period of a year, while we were building a television set, we used a piece of equipment that allowed us to put patterns on the screen, move them around. Those of you who are old enough to remember that televisions has had a bunch of controls up front for doing things like adjusting linearity, horizontal width, vertical height, contrast, brightness, on and on. I know that you had to have some piece of equipment at the factory, at least, to make all these adjustments to begin with. And we're looking at the ability of a person to move stuff around the screen, like these patterns and color bands, caused me to ask the chief engineer, who was my boss at the time, to think about maybe building something like a generator that puts patterns you could manipulate on the screen into a television set. Of course, the reaction was, forget it. You're already behind schedule, so forget it. If you ignore that bit, the next significant event in the saga was July 31st, 1966. I'm in New York. I'm sitting on the steps of a bus terminal. I'm waiting for another guy from Sanders Associates, who I worked to come in so we can go to a client. And the idea resurfaced of doing something interactive with a television set. I'm sure I didn't use the term interactive. I don't know when that term came into use. It's very hard to pin down just when these various terms came into use. In any event, I made some notes. Next morning, back in the office in Manchester, New Hampshire, where I was running a division of some 500 engineers and technical support people, I wrote a four-page paper on September 1st, 66. And anybody who wants to read it, go to the Smithsonian website and put in Ralph Baer, Smithsonian, Ralph Baer, and up will come pages and pages of archival material. They scanned all the stuff I gave them for some 500 documents.
Yeah, I read it, and it definitely first coined the term player, like as player one, player two. Without that, we might have been called contestants or time waster one, time waster two. So there's a lot of stuff in there that really maintained in the industry.
Well, I wouldn't call it, excuse me.
Sure.
considering gaming as a waste of time, I think is an unfair assessment. I mean, humanity has been playing games, I'm sure, since before they even spoke, right?
That's true, that's true. Most people think of playing video games as, you know, usually good memories. But I think we go through all the memories. I think it's good memories, bad memories. Sometimes it is wasting time. Sometimes it's getting away from reality. Sometimes it's brings out more appreciation for reality. Yes, it was made as a joke, but...
Okay, we'll leave it at that. Of course, it's all those things.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah, it's all those things. The same sense, some games are horrible. Some games are great. Some games are socially destructive. Some games are wonderful narratives. Of course, there's no difference between games or other forms of intellectual activity, including books, music, all forms of art.
Sure, you know, sure.
Video games are a form of art. Nobody can argue with that, except a complete idiot.
And there have been those complete idiots.
Especially in government.
Oh, okay. Very good. Yeah. Well, that's another show, I think. And one thing I like to bring up on the We Talk Games show is we have a pretty amazing audience out there, very dedicated, very knowledgeable. And one thing I constantly like to stress and bring up is the fact that, you know, the first video game console, this Magnavox Odyssey, was a cartridge-based system. You know, a lot of people have an old Pong or even the Odyssey tennis version in the garage somewhere. They don't realize that it had these removable circuit boards, and it was a cartridge-based system, basically.
Well, we had more than that. If you go back 5 years to 67, by the end of 67, we were playing ping pong, handball, volleyball, playing chase game, we were shooting at the spring light guns. I had a joystick on top of which was a golf ball, which you put on the floor and whacked with a real putter and moved one spot representing the ball across the screen in a pretty realistic fashion. Hopefully towards another spot, which was a hole, of course, with an overlay defining the surroundings, the grass, the hole, the flag, and all the other things that are part of a normal golf scene. And think about it. This is 67. We had joysticks. We had light guns. We had multiple game capability. And as you said, in 72, the Magnavox Odyssey machine made use of plug-in cards to go from game to game. I don't take credit for that concept. My machine, the round box, had a bunch of switches on it to go from game to game.
Okay.
Someone at Magnavox, and we still don't know who it was, came up with that alternative. Of course, it was picked up in later years. First, I think, by Fairchild F8 machine, right, which had a cartridge that looked like an 8-track cartridge, which everybody thought it was, right? Yeah. Because nobody had ever heard of ROM cartridges. You know, what's a ROM?
Yeah, yeah.
One of the things in that context I like to approach is the relationship between the development of video game hardware and software and electronic technology in general. Because at any one time in history, those of us who build hardware and do software are constrained by what we have to work with, the tools we have to work with. Yeah. And guess what? In 1966, 67, when we built this stuff, there was no such thing as a microprocessor.
Sure.
There were early integrated circuits which had a few flip-flops, some registers, counters, but they were bugs and they cost too much money, so they weren't an option for us in 1966. They were in 1972, when Magnavox put out the Odyssey. If you look inside the Odyssey, you see the old technology that we put into the brown box inside. Why? Well, I mean, it took us until 69 to find a licensee, Magnavox. It took the lawyers 2 years to screw around and finally come up with mutually agreeable contracts. And the engineers had all of 1 year to get a console into production. So what did they do? They copied what we had almost identically. Right? So here we had an obsolete technology and a brand new machine, because that's the real conditions under which everybody operated.
Yeah, that's where business comes in and messes up with innovation, I guess.
Exactly. Everybody thinks that when we talk about video games, we're talking about computer games. Not so. I mean,
it was really made for...
Talking about digital circuitry, yes, but we're not talking about computers, because computers are different altogether. They have a central processor, they have local memory in which things are stored, and that was not the case with the early games. The early games, like the Odyssey games, have digital circuitry in it. For example, a ball spot, which moves back and forth between paddles, is moved by a flip-flop. A flip-flop is as digital circuit as you can get, right?
Right, on or off.
To discover whether or not the ball is being intercepted by a paddle, you need a coincidence detection. It turns out to be a dual diode AND gate, right? Or an AND gate. Now, that's a digital circuit. On and on it goes. There's no analog circuitry.
Right, right.
Speak of in the old machines. And some protagonists had infiltrated into their cranium certain pieces of misinformation. Keep harping on the fact that the old games, like the Magnavox games, were analog. Total nonsense. People can't distinguish between digital circuits, pulse circuits, and analog circuits, because they know nothing about circuits, period. Right?
But how did you even get that idea for, like, a hit detection, like you're speaking of? I mean, you're working with, these potential. I'm not even sure if they're potentiometers, but these, I know Ohm's law, but that's about it. How did you think about how it's going to really do that flip-flop and make it?
Remember, the process was progressive. The first thing we put on a screen with a single spot, moved it around. Right? Yep. Then we took a chance and figured out how to do color in the background, real cheap, which didn't survive, by the way, in the Odyssey, too much like money. Mm-hmm. Then we said, well, if we got one spot, let's shoot at it. Yeah, when we lined up properly, the spot disappears, and you push a button, it reappears. Then we said, well, if we got one spot, we sure as hell can put two spots up there. What do we do with two spots? All right, we put an overlay on the screen, make it look like it's a checkerboard, right? And we create new rules and move two spots around and have a checkerboard game. When that gets pretty boring pretty quick, we say, what else can we do? Ah, we have one spot chase the other, right? Now, that gets pretty interesting. When you catch up with the other guy, the spot disappears, right?
Yep.
And you push a button, reappears, and you chase around. Using knobs for horizontal vertical positioning was kind of unsatisfactory. So bingo, the joystick was born, right? Which made it much easier to chase one guy for the other guy to disappear. When we had that, we said, well, let's put three spots up among the chase spots and call it hounds and fox type chase.
Uh-huh.
So one guy's moving three spots simultaneously on the screen, while the other guy, whose spot is colored red, because of course fox is red, right, is trying to get away from the hounds. And now we have the next thing is, we look at it, and we had a third guy with us, Bill Rush, who was an MIT graduate and pretty damn good at circuitry, very creative. He says, well, if we have two spots, we can make them into paddles, and another spot can become a ball. It was as simple as that.
I see.
Within a couple of weeks, we had a ball game going. In fact, by November of 67, we were playing ping pong and handball, and I had invited the VP at Teleprompter in New York to come up and look at what we were doing, and to consider putting games on the cable, which was nascent then and very small, like 100,000 subscribers in New York, and maybe another 100,000 in San Francisco or in L.A. One of the VPs from Teleprompter, one of the guys who designed the Teleprompter. And he was so impressed that he had the president of Teleprompter come up. Both of them were lucky enough to come up in the middle of a horrendous snowstorm. You know, we're in New Hampshire.
Sure.
We had winters in those days. And they decided, hey, this is great. The object was this. We can't put good symbology on the screen. Now, backgrounds are nothing. They're either a white screen, or if you want to spend the money on some fairly complex, expensive circuitry, including an expensive crystal at the chroma frequency, we can't put color up. What we can do is point a camera at a nice, colorful picture, right? Ship it over the cable, view it on a television screen, and arrange our game spots such that they are synchronized to what's up on the screen there, and overlay on that background.
Mm-hmm.
Now we can put Wimbledon up there and play tennis in Wimbledon. Huh? And the telepump that people said immediately, we started to negotiate a contract. I was down in New York a good part of the time doing the technical part, and they ran out of money. That was the end of that.
Wow. So we almost had, instead of
we almost had cable
house,
games going.
That is
Think
amazing.
About it, 30 years before we started doing cable games over, yeah, through the web.
Truly amazing. Did you ever think about using vinyl records as a storage medium, like CD systems or anything like that?
No, not vinyl records, because it's much too low data rates capable, you know, limited to 670 kilohertz. I know, but the time we were working on stuff, VCRs were already available.
Oh, okay.
I spent the better part of the late 60s and through the mid 70s integrating video games with VCRs, and later analog video disc, and after that CDs, yeah, DVDs. It really worked, right? It's only when the DVD became really a digital medium, downloaded stuff into a computer, that became practical.
Yeah, yeah. Relatively recently, compared to your career, you were given the National Medal of Technology by George W.
Yeah, that was quite an honor. That technology award is made once a year. Yeah, it's both a science medal and a technology medal. I was one of three guys who got the technology medal in 2006. It's just about as good as it gets, because that's roughly the equivalent of the Nobel Prize in technology.
So, Ralph, I guess your entire... Now, you started in electronics when you were 16 years of age, and I guess your entire career has been turning concepts into reality, putting the pieces in place to make that happen.
Yeah, and I don't want to make too big a deal of it, as I just said earlier. You know, if you're natively blessed with being creative, whether that's writing music or playing music, or whether it's painting or any other art, or whether it's engineering, all the same, you know, you're damn lucky to be that way. You know? Can't take credit for it. And enjoy it and make use of it.
I guess there is no single point of creation. I think that, you know, things progress. It's all a series of happenings that culminate or put together or put in different directions. And,
well, that's... It's called experience, right?
Sure, sure. Experience plays into knowing what to do with what you have. But as you were mentioning before, the Pong was not just a single point of invention. It was a process. And I think it's very important that people know the players in this process. And that's why I'm glad that your name is getting out there now more and more in books and in movies and documentaries and such. Because I'm very reminded of the fact that in 1943, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld Nikola Tesla's patent for the radio. But still to this day, we're taught that Marconi invented the radio. I think of you along the same lines as a Nikola Tesla. A lot of people didn't really know that Tesla was responsible for things that we use every day. And certainly everyone in the gaming community used something that you had your hand on at one time every day.
Well, I mean, I think that's a problem for historians to correct. You can't really do it in life unless you get real lucky. And I consider having had the President of the United States hanging a medal around my neck as being very lucky in that respect. And part of it also depends on whether or not you recognize that you've done something that really should be in the public domain, and you donate your papers, your hardware, and all this good stuff that relates to that activity, the proper places, like all my hardware, all my documents are at the Smithsonian, and replicas of the hardware are all over the world. I just came back from Germany on Sunday, and I was in Berlin, I was in Cologne, where I lived for 14 years, and everywhere I go, there are museums to whom I've contributed functional replicas of the brown box.
In addition to the brown box, which became the Odyssey 1, you also created Simon. People still can purchase this today. How did this come about?
Well, in the middle 70s, I was getting tired of running large organizations. apart from the fact that when you run a large organization, most of the time you deal with people problems. You get away from the technology, you become obsolete, and a natural-born engineer doesn't feel comfortable in that environment. So they made me the first engineering fellow at Sanders Associates at the time, later Lockheed Company, which was better because I now could pursue more R&D work and tutor more of the engineering rank and file, which was better. That wasn't good enough because I really wanted to build stuff. So I figured I'd like to build toys and games. I started to do it on my own. Wasn't very successful. I found out about a company called Marvin Glass and Associates, who were the largest toy and game designers, independent toy and game designers in the country at the time, Chicago. Make a long story short, I got on their team. I was the outside electronics capability for the better part of 10 years. And one of the very first things we did was a whole string of single-chip microprocessor games, of which the very first one was Simon.
Wow. Hit it right off the bat.
Yeah, right off the bat. It wasn't the first microprocessor application I handled, because when I first came to the company, they wanted me to do a remote controllable record player that could recognize bands and lands. So you could say, I want to play band 1, 3, and 5. Or if your wife said, hey, I like this this piece, I play it. And you could push a button and the needle would pick up, right? Move back and play the same thing again. And for that project, we needed a microprocessor. And the TMS-1000, a 4-bit processor with 1K of 4-bit memory, was available then from Texas Instruments, and it was inexpensive enough to be used in things like electronic toys and games. So we used it as Simon. After Simon came Mania, Computer Perfection, several others, all of which used that same microprocessor chip.
Right on.
I might mention that programming those chips was a real joy. I mean, when you think of program today, you get a vision of sitting next to your computer or next to your laptop, right?
Yeah.
And plugged into it is a little emulator system, and you're writing code, and you push a button, and the thing runs, and you see what's wrong, and you write some more code, and you push a button, and corrects the error in the code, and bingo, the thing works. Well, in those days, all we had was a paper tape mechanism on which to store data, and a telephone with which to talk to a computer somewhere in Pennsylvania, which TI had their program for that chip resident. And so at the end of each month, my telephone bill would look like the national debt. And, of course, all this back and forth took place at about 120 baud a second, which is roughly 120 bits, never mind bytes. Yeah. Bits a second. Took forever.
And you actually had to burn the chips then, I guess, as well, right?
Yeah, they had... there were TMS-1000 versions that had output I/O lines, input-output lines, that could support an external ROM. So that was already in place at the time.
Anything else that you want to leave the people with?
Actually, for the next 25 years, I've built those games. I still do on occasion. I run a program on a little micro on a PC for these games. Also did a with another fellow, one-third my age, in California, a device that was related to DDR and the Dance Dance Revolution.
Oh,
I can't describe it, which was taken up by Logitech and they spent quite a bit of money on developing it, but I did a poor job of romancing Konami, and as a result, so that didn't go anywhere. Yeah. Although I have no complaints because I made quite a bit of money. So I'm still cranking. And I'm still in demand, which I must cut down because it's getting too hard to run around the world and make short speeches. On Wednesday night at midnight, I was on the stage in the city of Cologne, Germany, at a game developers conference with about 250, 300 people in the room. And I had the honor of introducing Alexei Pajanov, the guy who did Tetris,
sure,
and hand him an award. It was kind of late. It was midnight.
Oh, my goodness.
Well past my bedtime. And the next day, I was in Pirmas, the town I was born in, southwest of Germany, at a museum where I donated to an old Simon, the brown box that's in daily use by hundreds of kids to come through and with school groups. And 3 weeks from now, I'm going to be in Leipzig, Germany, at the online games convention, which will be a very big deal.
Wow.
And a couple of days before, I'll be in Berlin at the Berlin Game Museum. I've been working with them for about a year on a timeline, interactive timeline, which you can access through the web, and which has pull down pictures and movies that describes the genesis of video game history. And we will introduce that to the public on the 29th of this month in the presence of all the government people.
Thank you, Ralph Baer. Have fun on your return trip to Germany. You definitely deserve the recognition. It's been a privilege to have you on our show. Thank you again for being on We Talk Games.
You're entirely welcome, if that's it. Wish you lots of luck and lots of success. Lots of good music.
Thank you very much, Ralph.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Wow. Wow. And I got to tell you, there's a lot of footage that had to be cut out. We were talking about his early days in audio and the type of audio I do, and when I used to fix speakers at the drive-in movies, and plus trying to get our Dick Tracy two-way wrist televisions to work. That was another stumbling block. But Ralph insisted on video conferencing, and that's what he got. He also gave Kyle a lot of poop talk, you see, for not having a $25 video camera hooked up to his Skype. So, Ralph Baer, I wish him many, many, many more years, and he's still creating things. He's still got stuff cooking in his computers, different types of secret projects that he's not allowed to divulge. He also aspires to be on a postage stamp, and who deserves it more than the good old Ralph Baer? But what a pleasure. And speaking about pleasure, let's get a new correspondent on the line. This is amazing. Open it up, Keith. Charlotte, North Carolina, go! You're on. Can you hear me?
What? What was that?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I almost feel like I have like sort of an echo.
Oh, echo. Oh, I'm sorry. It's probably our transatlantic connection here. There we go. How about that?
Yeah,
better one, better two.
I feel like I'm at the eye doctor.
Now, before anyone gets the idea that I'm talking to like an 11-year-old boy that listens to our show, you are Heather Sanchez of GameGirl.com.
Yes, I might be. I might also be an imposter. You'll never know.
This is true. This is true. That could happen. I wouldn't put that past any of our listeners.